Greetings. This is KPOO 89.5 and KPOO.com, broadcasting from what's left of the Fillmore in San Francisco. We open with Nina Simone. Welcome to Nina Viva, our name for this monthly segment of For the People. Much thanks to Terry Collins for the invite and engineering. I'm Arlene Eisen. I've planned this show to feature women's voices, especially those of us active in struggles to bring down the empire. The empire founded on the theft of Native people's land and African people's enslavement, perpetuated by white supremacy, patriarchy, and profit. For a belated Mother's Day celebration, we have four mothers in the studio, all of whom have long experience in nurturing and preparing our black and brown sons and daughters to thrive in the face of the white supremacist, patriarchal, profit-driven society. And we're going to jump right in, talking about what we've learned in this struggle with raising our kids. And so I'm going to ask each of my wonderful guests here to introduce themselves. I also wanted to send a shout out to my sons, Tungo and Biko, for helping develop this list of questions along with the wonderful women who are sitting with me. So, Christina, could you start, please?
Hi, my name is Maria Cristina Gutierrez. I have two children and six grandchildren and one great-grandchild. My children are black, Asian, Latino, and my two children, one is 40 years old, the other one is 50 years old, and I have them when I was about 20 years old, and I raised them here in San Francisco, and I consider myself a socialist. I'm struggling. And I've been struggling all my life to leave my children a legacy, a world that is better than they have here right now.
Jenny.
I'm Jenny Lim, and I had two daughters. Now I have one. One passed away at 19. The 16th would have been her 37th birthday, I believe. And she passed away 2 days before 9/11 in a tragic rafting accident. I have a surviving daughter. She's 40 now. I have three grandchildren of mixed blood, Asian American. They're Chinese American, Greek, Italian, and Latino. And those three grandchildren are my heart and joy. And I raise them as a single mother. I also consider myself a socialist, Marxist socialist.
Greetings. I'm Carla Yemenya Kennedy Shahid. I have one son, one blessedly black son. He is 17. He'll be 18 in July. I raised him primarily as a single parent and in Oakland for the last 4 years in El Sobrante. I consider myself, I would say, a black nationalist.
And I'm Arlene Eisen. I'm white. My children's father was black, and I raised them in the black community. They identify as black. I'm not going to tell you my kids' ages. They're grown men. I had them fairly late in life. I was 37 when I had my first son. I was a single parent all the way. They were raised in San Francisco, and I'd say I'm a Marxist socialist too, and very active anti-imperialist and feminist. So the first substantive question, or before I get into this, I don't know how many of you saw the announcement today online about a young 12-year-old black boy who was at a carnival in Sacramento, and he got into some scuffle with somebody at the carnival, and the security guards called the police. He was arrested or wrestled to the ground, handcuffed, the whole, you know, horrible image. And then they put a bag over his head, a plastic bag, in the tradition of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and all the torture throughout history. And I just wanted to take a moment to think about what this means for us raising our children in this kind of environment. So without scaring the hell, without scaring them very much, how do we prepare our children for this kind of struggle? Does this grab any of you, this question?
I am wrestling with whether or not I have actually prepared him. I'm sending my son off this fall to college, you know, the first time that he will be outside of my care. And, you know, I have moments when I am actually terrified at the thought of him being out there alone and, you know, defenseless. How I've prepared him is to always encourage him to be level-minded, to be patient, to be thoughtful in his actions, and to appeal to people's greater selves in every interaction, and especially if and when he has to deal with the police.
Well, I know, Jenny, the issues facing girls are a little different, but there are different physical dangers out there for girls, and particularly Asian girls. How did you prepare your kids for that?
Well, I taught them not to be shrinking violets and to stand their ground, of course not with weapons, but with their dignity and with their mouths, to stand up for themselves and not take abuse by anybody. I mean, just a couple of months ago, my daughter is taking her two kids to school, and, you know, there's such a hectic traffic jam near the elementary school, so she was parked a little bit in front of a driveway. And when she came back, this guy started yelling and screaming at her, and she was so flustered, she had the child and the younger one and put him in the car seat, and she was so frustrated, she crumpled a piece of paper and threw it, you know, at his lawn. And he chased after her a couple of blocks in fury, and he had also thrown mud all over her car. And she reported to the police, and they said they didn't see any injury to her, and they didn't do a thing. And I believe, you know, it's, you know, Burlingame, very white, upper middle class community, and here's this Asian woman complaining against a white man. And, you know, I see there's always been this apartheid justice operating ever since the old, you know, days of the Confederacy. Lots of things haven't changed.
Right. How about you, Christina?
Well, I try to empower my children, you know, but I want to make a big difference. My son, for example, he is half Japanese. And, you know, he went through some issues, you know, being called Chinaman and all these things. But what I have seen happen to black people and black children in this country is unbelievable. I mean, it's nothing compared to that. I'd be very honest with you. And I happen to have black grandkids. And that my grandson is 19 years old. He's going to the university, right? And I really suffer for him, and I have to hold myself down so that I can empower him instead of, you know, make him afraid and fear about going out. I don't want that to happen to him. I want him to have a regular life. So I always try to tell him that he has the power to change these things, but that he needs to unite with other people, that he needs to organize, that this is a fight. This is a struggle. That's what I always tell them. It's a struggle. You have to fight for it. Nothing is going to come your way. You're going to fight for it because this nation is a racist nation. It was born out of the enslavement of black people that were brought by force from Africa. It was born out of the genocide of Native American people. And it was born out of the exploitation and colonization on countries throughout, of black and brown people throughout the world. And I try to empower them because even though I fear, but I do not want him to grow up like that. And he's so handsome.
I raised my boys in the 80s when the crack epidemic was at its peak. And I tried very hard not just to insulate. Well, I tried to inoculate them against racism. So from the time they were babies, even before they had full language, I started talking to them about racism as being a white person's problem and not their problem. Mm-hmm. And along the lines of what you're saying, Christina, about empowerment, of there was nothing wrong with them. It was white people's sickness. I think that was the term that I used when they were very, very young. And they had a language and a sense that from all kinds of institutions that they participated in, like the Western Addition Cultural Center, that's now the African American Cultural Center, used to have Black kids drama groups and capoeira and all this kind of programs and soccer groups. You know, I tried to give them a sense of community from which they could gather strength and support. Did you all find institutions to give you that kind of support?
No, I didn't. I don't know that. You know, my son wasn't necessarily interested in doing those kinds of things. I did send him to an African-centered independent school in East Oakland for several years. But I think that the majority of his strength came from me and from my family, you know. Talking about race is just a regularity in our house. It always has been. You know, I encouraged him to celebrate who he is, and I celebrated who we are. But beyond that, no, I didn't seek outside institutions for that, no.
Neither did I. And I think I'm a little older than Ye, and in my day, there weren't many institutions to support moms of any color. And so it was mainly friends, you know, a lot of, you know, family. And coming from an immigrant working class background in San Francisco, it was very difficult because, you know, I didn't fit the, you know, the preferred Chinese American motto minority nuclear family. Here I was with two girls raising them in Western Addition. And in a very multicultural environment. So their kids were very mixed. And I think because of that, their perspective was very multicultural. We never, you know, just band behind Chinatown issues or, you know, Asian American issues. I've always, and they're like myself, we are behind Black Lives Matter. I think because if we just segregate ourselves and fight for our own issues in our own communities, we'll never get anywhere, and that's what they want to happen. So I constantly try to foster that unity among folks of color.
But to me, the movement was the source of the help for my children. My family too, obviously, but I think being around people who were struggling constantly for justice, for equality, for all these things, has really helped me a lot, you know. And I know that when we went on a hunger strike against the, you know, what was going on with the police, I remember my grandson, you know, talking about how for him it was such a beautiful experience, you know what I mean, how proud he was of what we were doing. But it has always been that movement, you know, not agency, not institutions, but the people that are fighting, you know, seeing them, talking to them, it empowered them, it made them believe, yeah, I can do it too, you know. And to me, that's what has been the help.
I know your son, and I've worked with him, Ilyich Sato, wonderful, Equipto, I've done productions with him, and his consciousness and his passion is right on, so I can give you credit for that.
It's good, but I tell you, you know, nobody talks about my daughter. Mm-hmm. And my daughter is the heart. Mm-hmm. Is the heart. You know, nobody knows her because maybe my son and I are very loud. She's very quiet. But without her, nothing would have been done. Mm.
Nothing. Was she an older or a younger sister?
She's the older sister. She's the one who's 50, the one that gave me the 6 grandkids and the 1 great-grandchild. Uh-huh. She's a tremendous, tremendous young woman, you know, to me, always, and she was very little.
Well, speaking of daughters, which I have no experience raising, And this was also a question that I know Ye was interested in, which is a little more contemporary, but how do we raise our daughters, you know, to resist the various pressures to be objects and have the confidence and not to be taken advantage of and so on? Could you be kind of specific of that, in that? Or are there any examples that?
Well, I think because we were so tight, I was raising them by myself mostly, and I didn't have any babysitters, so I basically brought them everywhere I went. That meant to all my poetry readings. Yeah, that meant all of my jazz musician friends, African American, Asian American activists. And so they grew up in that environment. And there were times when my daughter would be sitting back there and she would be mouthing my poem because she knew it by heart. And so I think they complained a lot about being dragged around all over, but I think it was that closeness. They really saw what I did and what I was about. So that was a teaching. I was constantly teaching them by being with them and you know, trying to walk my talk. And it turns around that they actually taught me as they grew older. They would, if they saw contradictions in my behavior, like one time I was, you know, going on about some people walking, wearing furs down the street, you know, and my daughter says, well, look at you, you're wearing leather. So, you know, they were also very critical of me, and so we taught each other.
But to me, I raised them in, like, the same way, and one thing that I found is that I'm made it proud of being able to be a mother. That was a beautiful gift that we have, you know, because I'm a woman of faith too, even though I consider myself a revolutionary, you know. And I always told my daughter, you know, that she was the giver of life, that we are the givers of life, so we are the fighters of that life. And that's empowering, you know, and that's what I always felt, that just like with boys, the girls, we need to empower them, that yes, we are human beings, we're beautiful, and we are oppressed, and we can change that ourselves. That is up to us to change that.
Mm-hmm. So on the flip side, in terms of, you've had sons also, and yay, especially, I remember when my kids were toddlers, I saw a book. The title of it was How Not to Have Your Sons Stolen by the Patriarchy. Ah. You know, for feminists who wanted to raise their kids to respect women. And then as they get older, of course, they have the, especially in this era of Me Too, mm-hmm. they have this issue of are their movements going to be monitored, especially, you know, there are stereotypes of the predatory black man or the Latin lover or something, you know, are their movements going to be, how do we deal with that contradiction?
That's a great question. From a young age, I talked to my son about the privilege that his maleness afforded him and would have him practice, I don't want to say, because it wasn't about chivalry. It was about being aware that girls need for boys to be mindful and to stand up for them. And so I would have him, you know, practice kindness with his girl cousins who were all younger. You know, if he would open the door for me, then open the door for them, to not talk over them or, you know, decide that it was all going to go his way, mm-hmm. you know, to flex his muscles in situations where there was, conflict. And I also had him do things like, you know, help me, that it was required of him to bring the groceries in the house, unpack the groceries, it still is, do laundry, help, be helpful, realize that he had a responsibility to help take care of the household, to care for the girls and the women in his life, and that care had to extend to areas in which they were not present. But I am concerned still. I mean, that's a big question for me about how to protect the boys who are doubly stigmatized when it comes to sexuality and these notions of who they are.
Personally, you know, I think that in this system is so difficult for us to be able to teach the young men in general, you know, against all this machismo, we call it, or this, you know, male thing, because everywhere they go in the culture, in the music and all this stuff is out there. So it is a real struggle. I was blessed because I have my daughter that it is very strong. And she was like a mother to him, even though she's not that much older. She's 5 years older than he is. But she, you know, very strong. And so he always was surrendered by women, very, you know, outspoken women. And we were always fighting and, you know, for justice and all the stuff. And she always stood by his side when they tried to throw him in the garbage and call him Chinaman and all that. You know, she was there struggling for her brother. So he developed that respect for women out of that experience of knowing that we stood by him, that we fought. And so he knew that he had to stand by us. But I believe that we need to really talk to our children about the truth of how, you know, this system has this way of looking at life and society, and that we need to change it, that we need to change it, and that every day is a challenge. Because I myself sometimes do think that I go, like you were saying before, like, what am I doing, you know, because the system is so strong, pushing all these ideas. Mm-hmm. So that's what I try to see. I always concentrate that there's a struggle that capitalism, excuse me for using the word, but capitalism, you know, is not there to help us. We're never going to find a solution to that. We cannot fix it. We need to see beyond that, and we need to look for real solutions. And in the process, we're going to make a lot of mistakes, and our children are going to make a lot of mistakes, you know. My son was never interested in politics for quite a while, and then he got very interested. My daughter has been always very interested in it in a total different way, you know, always serving, always serving. I always told my kids that everything in life, our purpose in life, is to serve people. to serve one another. That's how I try.
Well, before we continue with this, I have to do station identification. This is KPOO 89.5 in San Francisco and online at kpoo.com. So to continue this issue, it overlaps in my mind with the issue of the pervasiveness of white supremacy, male supremacy, you know, really poisonous ideas, which I think particularly in adolescence, it's I think it, in some ways, I don't know if it's true for you all, but in my house, for a while, some of those ideas were impossible to take on, certainly not head on. And I had to choose my battles very, very carefully. So because I feel like before 13 years, I could be, you know, raving, take them on every march, talk to them about the Black Panthers and racism and how the people of the world were going to win and all this kind of stuff. And also a very anti-materialist approach. I mean, we were on welfare for 10 years, so it didn't have much choice about not being able to buy them all the stuff they wanted. But once the teen years hit, all bets were off, and I felt like I did. If I tried to keep control over the situation, I would have alienated them even more, although they'll tell you that I was very controlling. But I felt like I chose my battles very selectively. I see you all nodding. Could you give us some examples and why you chose one battle over another? Or,
well, I wanted to focus on my brother because he was one brother out of seven girls. And raised in a very traditional, my parents were first generation Chinese immigrants. And so they raised him with the very Chinese patriarchal values. And what I saw was this sense of entitlement and privilege that he enjoyed within the family. But outside of the family, he was nothing in the white patriarchal world. And I see this binary happening in men of color, where they go home and they assert their masculinity, their sexism, and their, you know, entitlement on the women of the family. And it becomes even more pronounced and exaggerated because of the discrimination and racism they feel outside of that family. And so what happens is the women become victimized. I always felt victimized by my brother, and I always vehemently hated him growing up because I always felt he bullied me. And then retrospect, after we don't even talk to each other now because of, you know, his, he feels that I'm just, you know, I'm not obedient enough to be in the family or something. And because I, you know, I don't defer to him as the male, patriarch. So now I look at him and I actually feel sorry for him because I realize that he had a very insecure sense of himself. It was very, grew up and it was either the police or the authority figures in the school. He was sent to juvenile hall, log cabin, and the parents couldn't control him because he didn't know how to act out the resentment and bitterness he felt against the white, you know, patriarchal world. So I think when I look at my grandchildren, I want to learn from that. I do not want to instill those kind of destructive, you know, entitlement values on them. But at the same time, I want, you know, it's tricky, that paradox. I want them to be strong and, you know, hold their heads up high when they have to deal with the white patriarchal system.
Christina?
Well, I tell you, one of the things that to me I find that always helped me, right? And I know they said, my kids, if you tell them, they tell you that I was impossible. For example, I told my daughter, you do not do the pledge of allegiance in your school. And they sat her down in the closet. And I said, it's okay. I said, you do that, you don't care. You're not going to do that to that black. And that was a no. And she grew up with that, you know. They reveal a little bit, but they come back later to what you teach them. You know, it's funny. It's just like when my grandmother used to teach me to pray certain prayers, right? Now that I'm older, I'm remembering those prayers because they were there. They taught you that when you were little. It's the same thing with these values that we teach him. You know, the same thing I told my son, you know. One time I remember being very little, he came and he used the word B to describe one of the girls. And I said, what is that? What are you talking about? Well, that's what they said at school. I said, you don't repeat what you said at school. That is not nice. Would you like somebody to call me that? Would you like to do this? Well, he didn't really understood what it was. And I told him that's a very bad word put to identify a woman. And TV, I told him, you know, that's a racist program. They said, I hate when my mother is here because whenever we watch TV, she's saying, you don't do this. And I feel that it paid off in the long run. For a long time, they fought me. They didn't like what I taught them. Taught my grandkids too. They go, like, oh, here come grandma, you know, because I tell them, no, you don't do that. And I believe that that pays off in the long run. It pays off.
Right.
Well, I'm at a loss for a story. My son, I don't know. He's just, I haven't observed him straying from my values. I mean, he just, I don't know if it's the closeness that it was just the two of us for so long. And then also just his personality. So I feel lucky in that regard. And I definitely am aware that, you know, that is not the norm, that mm-hmm. lots of people have a different story to tell.
One thing I not necessary to share with the experienced women in this studio right now, but if anyone's listening who's a young mother, I want to say something that my children were not allowed to watch TV, period. In fact, until they were quite old, they believed that the only TV station our machine received was Sesame Street. Mm-hmm. and it was in the early days of videos, and all the videos we had were very, very hand-selected. At the time, Star Wars became a big thing, and a lot of their friends were talking about Star Wars. And they weren't allowed to watch Star Wars unless they deconstructed it afterwards and explained to me how it was sexist and how it was racist and who the heroes were and why all the heroes were white and that sort of thing. And I think it's very, very important, and I imagine much more challenging in this day when the monitors, the screens, the cell phones, the tablets, etc., become like babysitters and just omnipresent. And I don't know if you've had to deal with that with your grandchildren or not.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm blessed to see my daughter don't allow them to have cell phones. Lydia, my granddaughter that is now 27 is the one that has a phone, and she doesn't have Facebook. She uses it to call and all the stuff. There's no TV in the house. There's nothing for them, you know, to do that. They complain, and they said, oh, Mom, give us a phone. They call me thinking that Grandma will give him one, right, because you know how grandmas are, right? So, but the fact is that I'm blessed in that sense that they don't have that. But I work in a school, and I see babies that are 3 years old that come to the preschool, and they are with a cell phone there all the time. And I keep telling the mom, please, don't do that, you know, I'm not allowing this. You cannot, even when you are in the waiting room, you cannot have those cell phones because, you know, it's just, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. But that's a real problem. And we deal with that in the school. We talk to the parents and all that, you know. But it amazes me when I see that. And then I see that I'm blessed that my grandchildren don't do that. But now you look at all of us, and we are all hung up on that telephone sometimes, you know. And it's a, I always said I'm doing it for political reasons, right? And I try to hold them to that level.
Well, I don't have, I have that problem with my grandsons. They all have iPads, and yeah, and their parents are always with their, on the laptop, on their cell phones. And, you know, that's how they are. And the kids are constantly getting electronic toys. And the oldest one, he's 18, he plays video games. And I said, please don't get the grandchildren, you know, the younger ones hooked on the video games. They saw it once, and they were hypnotized. Mm-hmm. And they kept asking him for it. And then my daughter put her foot down and said, this is not a family bonding experience. Because the father would say, oh, this is for kids. You know, they have them, you know, video games for 3-year-olds, 7-year-olds. And my, thankfully, my daughter put her foot down. But it's a struggle.
I would say it's more of a struggle now. My son didn't get a cell phone until he was 9. And to me, that's young, yeah. But it was the first year that I wasn't the person picking him up from school, and I needed to get in touch with him. And then he got a smartphone at 14. So, you know, growing up, he couldn't watch anything but PBS for like the first 5 years, and I became very aware of the difference because once he started watching regular television, he was asking me for all the toys that he would see on the commercials. There's no commercials on PBS. So, yeah, I think now it's more of a concern that he spends, I think, too much time. He loves Twitter. And I talked to him about that. But, you know, I've always loved reading. We always read together. He read so much up until high school, just would read. And so we escaped some of that, that early screen time and those struggles. But now it's you know, it's not really a struggle because I just let him have it. But I send him articles. I send him studies about what's it doing to your brain. You know, I tell him that it's dogging his mood. That's why he feels down. And it's one of those things at this point that he's going to have to sort out for himself.
Well, that raises another kind of issue, too, of having how to motivate our kids to read a lot or to so-called do the right thing without pressuring them, without being making them feel bad if they don't live up to expectations. I mean, is that? Yes, go ahead.
You know what? The system pressure them to do all that. Why cannot we pressure them? You know, the TV pressure them, the newspaper pressure them, you know, the school, the peer people, you know. So we need to, I figured that out. I said, I want to put pressure on the other side, you know, and they're going to get angry at me. But later on, they're going to be grateful, you know, at what he said. Like I said with my grandkids, for example, you know, they know. That I teach them, you do not talk to each other that way. You need to talk nice. That bullying and all that garbage that you see in the school is not for you. When they do it, you know, and I sit them down and I say, you know, this is what it does. That's how people look at you this way. They treat you this way. That's how they label you. That's how it is. So you need to understand that you are a beautiful human being. Don't allow them to look at you that way. Stop that. If you don't stop that, then there's going to be consequences. And the consequences is I take anything away. If I give them sometimes a little money, I was going to give you $20, but you're not going to get anything because that's not what my granddaughter should behave like. So they know, but they love me. And whenever they see me, like, I love you, Grandma. You're so good. We miss you, you know, and all this stuff. But I figured that we had to do that because the system does it every day. They do it every day by any means necessary, as Malcolm X said. And we got to do it by any means necessary to get our kids away from all the ugliness that this system is putting at their hands to destroy the beautiful soul that they have.
And for mothers with young children, I would say, you know, start early. My son had his own bookshelf as, you know, an infant. I mean, there were books that were cloth books that he could crawl over to the bookshelf and he could touch them. And so it was never a no situation, right? He could satisfy his curiosity. He could eat them, you know, taste them, you know, how babies figure out things, the world, by through all of the senses. Mm-hmm. And then we had a nightly story time, and we would read, and I would be really just demonstrative in reading the stories, and just made him, helped him to fall in love with using his imagination. You know, I can't stress how important that is, because when they develop a love of reading, that's mm-hmm. even if they don't read for a time, that's something that never really goes away. And there's a real important value in that, in terms of like liberation, right? Liberating ourselves, that you, there's so much knowledge and information that can help us to free ourselves. And so they need to know that they can go to a book. And also, don't judge what they read. Mm-hmm. I let him read lots of comic books. I want him to read. That's the point. I feel like my mom, she would only make the vegetables that we liked. And she said, it's because I want you to eat vegetables, not because I want you to eat a certain vegetable or the vegetables that I like. I want you to eat vegetables. And I want you to know that there are vegetables that you actually enjoy. So I kind of use that same psychology when it comes to books. Read whatever you like. It's important that you read.
I've been giving the idea of parenting a lot of thought lately, because I see a lot of extreme styles of parenting. One where they want to overdo all the books, you know, they're going to start training them when they're still in the womb by putting, you know, music, you know, playing music for the fetus. They're going to get in them all these classes. They're going to get these books. They're going to get them. And if there's a college prep class in preschool, they'll put them in that, you know. And there's this desire to want this kid to excel and compete so badly that you stifle the child. And these are children. And I think children learn best when there's a sense of play involved in learning. And as soon as you say, you have to do this, you have to read tonight, they're going to instantly rebel. Why should I? That's no fun, you know? And there's not enough time. They're talking about, I read somewhere, of abolishing recess yeah. in some school district. Mm-hmm. And I said, the kids do all their learning, they're socializing out in the playground. They need to be out in nature. And I think the more time kids spend out in nature, and the more they have a sense of connection, and that's where they learn kindness. You could with the butterflies and the birds, and they interconnect, and they can communicate with little animals, with squirrels, and you know. So there has to be a sense of play and a sense of fun about learning anything, whether it's to draw or to read. If you make the story interesting, if you use your I made up stories when my daughter got bored, and it went on like a serial about Mortimer the spider. And she loved it. She goes, tell. And I only did it because I was so tired at night. I couldn't even read. My eyes would start crossing. So I would start telling stories. I could lie in bed next to her. And then she'd say, hey, mom, because I had fallen asleep. Now I'm doing that with my grandson. I tell him stories about Zombie-san. And she goes, grandma, tell me that story. And then he goes to sleep.
That raises another question that we're running out of time that I'd like to ask everybody here is, when you mentioned that you're very tired, you would be very tired at the end of the day, but you told the story or read the book anyway. Motherhood can be all-consuming. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering how this work, 24/7 work, affected you. And we've been talking about what we've been doing for our kids, but how it affected your emotional, your work life, your political life. What did you learn from it, if anything? I'm sure you learned a lot, but that's a silly question. But how did it affect you?
It's like, what didn't I learn from it, right? All-consuming is an understatement. What I had to do, because I was a single mom, was I had to show it all to him. That I had to, he knew when I was tired. He knew when I was sad. He knew when I was heartbroken. Maybe he didn't understand it, but he saw me go through the emotion. Mm-hmm. I had to learn to forgive myself and practice forgiveness on a daily basis. And so that I wouldn't, you know, beat myself up over the ways that I felt like I had not been the best me on any given day. And I also learned to apologize to him, which was something that I really wanted and needed in my childhood from time to time. And so I gave it to him.
Yeah, I agree. You do need to learn to forgive yourself, because especially if you're a single mom, there's so many moments when, you know, you lose it. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's so easy to, you know, start yelling, right, and threatening the kids. And then when you get into that mode, you've, you know, really lost them. And so I see that happening with my kids, you know, with their grandkids, because they're so burnt out after work and they come home and they're climbing the cupboards and whatnot and making a huge mess. And I see that they're losing control. And I think it's important to set aside time for yourself. That's something I didn't do enough of, because I felt I didn't have that, I didn't have that luxury to take time for myself, not realizing that it was, pretty urgent.
Yeah. To me, you know, I don't feel that way. You know, I enjoy my kids. I blew it sometimes. I did good other times. But I accept it like it is. You know, I don't have this trip that the system put on you to feel guilty and that you're bad and that, you know, this is what I expect from you to be a mom. I don't go by that. I'm a human being. And I tell that to my kids. I'm a human being. I'm going to be some days really good. Some days I'm going to be a little messy, you know what I mean? But I love you. I love you, and I want, and you know, it's to dream, and I want to finish with that, to dream in any way for me that I can be anything better in a system as cruel as this is, in a system that has destroyed all kind of values, all kind of support for mothers, all kind of educational system that really work for our children. For me to try to overcome that by myself with my own kid is impossible. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You can try, but that is impossible. So that's why, to me, empowering means I tell my kids, to me, is to tell my kids, you know, we need to do this. The reality of life is this. And we need to follow these directions. And, you know, you need to walk the right way, and you need to eat the right food, and you need to do that. If they like it, fine. But, you know, all this, excuse me for saying this, white middle class psychology that they try to apply to our own kids, I'm sick and tired of that, because all of that is make black and brown mothers feel guilty for the way that we had to deal with this crazy world. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to feel guilty about that. I love my children, and I always said I did the best that I could. Not that you wanted it, but the best that I can. And I am happy about it because I have a conscience and I know what's happening in the world. And I'm not going to let the world destroy my and your relationship. We may have an argument today. We may not agree. And we don't agree a lot of times. But my love, I love you. And this is what it is, you know, and I'm not saying.
Right. And that spirit, too, the last issue I wanted to give you guys time, you women, time to talk about, and we only have 3 more minutes, I'm sorry, okay. is you started in the beginning talking about it's being a mother that in some sense motivates our continue to fight. I know for me, I worked very, very hard on this study that found that every 28 hours, a young black man is, or yeah. Black man is killed okay. by police. Mm-hmm. And what really motivated that work, aside from my intellectual understanding of white supremacy and imperialism and so on, was somehow I felt like if I documented these atrocities, somehow it would save my kids. Mm-hmm. And so with that kind of thing in mind, I'm wondering if in the last couple of minutes there's any activity. I know you, Christina, mm-hmm. are involved in a weekly activity. I'm not sure what the rest of you are involved with that you want to talk about on the air to recruit people to.
Well, really quickly, what we do every week, every Friday from 12 to 2, we go in front of the police, the A50 Bryan, the Hall of Justice, to demand that the killer cat be charged with murder, that go to jail, you know. And we always said we're not doing it only for those who have been killed, but we do it for our own children because we don't want the name to be there. We don't want the picture to be on that wall. And so that's why we come. And we believe in going there and teaching every person that come into that building, everybody that walk by, to touch their heart, to tell you, you know, you can make a difference. You have the power. And I'm a mama. And I have that baby for 9 months in my belly. I love it. And I work for it. And I have all the hope for his life, for her life, and so therefore that's why I'm here. Don't feel sorry for me. This is not a sacrifice. This is an act of love. Mm-hmm. This is an act of love that I am doing, and all the mothers are doing. There's a few mm-hmm. of us who are doing it, and you know we are. That's what we do.
Is there a place people can get more information about this?
No. Usually, what we do is every Friday, 12 to 2, 850 Bryan Street. 12 to every Friday. That's what we're there.
Well, I'm a writer, and I have a background in journalism, so, and I take care of my grandkids 3 days a week, so I put a lot of my time and effort in researching, investigating information regarding imperialist policies, global policies around the world. I have a active website, Facebook, Artists Against Attacks on Gaza, that hits about 400 to 500, 600, 700 hits a week. And then I had one, I have over 2,600 followers under Genevieve Lim, and that was shut down by Facebook recently and not been able to use that at all. Mm-hmm. So I manage another account, but I'm not able to make any comments anymore. No editorial comments, analysis, and anything regarding Israel.
Is there something you want to recommend that people do?
I think they really need to shut down their shut off their ears to the media propaganda that they hear 24/7 on the corporate news media, and they really need to go to alternative news sites. There's so many of them. You can find them in social media, and that will give you the alternative perspectives that is not getting out there.
I'm sorry, we're out of time. Was this something really quick? No. This is KPOO 89.5 FM in San Francisco and online at kpoo.com. This is Arlene Eisen with Yemaya Kennedy Shahid, Maria Cristina Gutierrez, and Jenny Lim. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll be here again next month on the third Tuesday of the month, June 18th.